The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Hi, I'm Brad Bannon. I'm the host of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm a national Democratic strategist and pollster, a columnist for The Hill, and a political analyst for news radio station KNX in Los Angeles. My company, Bannon Communications Research, polls for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. Mondays on Deadline DC, I talk to the people and players behind the politics and policies that drive our great nation forward. With us, as is always is our executive producer, Mark Grimaldi, who makes sure the show stays online and runs on time. This week, we have a couple of great guests. Our guest in the first half hour is Kate Ackley, a reporter from Bloomberg News. You can see her there from the what I suspect is the Bloomberg News newsroom. In the second half, and she's going to talk to us about the big congressional battle over TikTok and also the impact of a special interest money on campaign 2024. Then in the second half hour, our guest is Tim Carr, who is Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, who is going to talk about media coverage of Donald Trump. But before we get to Kate, let's play this clip from CBS News on the battle over TikTok.
Breaking news, a bill that would ban TikTok here in the U.S. if the company does not divest from its parent company based in China, is headed right to the Senate.
That's right. House lawmakers passed the bill with a large majority. 352 House members voted in favor of this bill. 65 voted against it. More Republicans than Democrats supported it, but it was definitely bipartisan.
Shortly after the vote, TikTok released this statement. The company said in part, it is, quote, hopeful the Senate will consider the facts and listen to their constituents. Now, TikTok also warned of the harmful impact this measure could have on users and the U.S. economy as a whole. CBS News congressional correspondent Scott McFarland joins us from Capitol Hill with more on this. Scott, is the amount of bipartisan House support this bill received surprising at all to you?
Everything about this was surprising. We just watched the political version of a runaway train. It picked up speed and it picked up force without blinking once. The bill was introduced a week ago yesterday on the House floor. It took just 8 days to get this thing through with an overwhelming vote of support. You just don't see that often, certainly not in this uniquely gridlocked and dysfunctional Congress. And one of the things I think was strategic here was the faster they moved, the faster supporters were able to avoid the opposition galvanizing and mobilizing. TikTok tried to slow this down. They tried to get dissenting voices out there. They brought their biggest influencers and users to Washington, D.C. to get FaceTime with lawmakers. Their CEO is here in Washington, but they couldn't quite stop the freight train from speeding down the tracks.
Well, and Scott, I understand you've actually been speaking to TikTok users at the Capitol. What have they told you today?
Yeah, they're advocating that this is not a good read of the situation by Congress. They say it's a Congress that clearly doesn't understand the platform, doesn't understand the value of the platform, and isn't really speaking for all of its constituents. This is a difficult thing to replicate in the U.S. Senate. But what TikTok is doing here by bringing in its influencers, its members, it's also necessarily bringing in constituents of the people who'll be voting on this in Congress. And so far that has not worked. But let me tell you, there's one place in the world that can stop a runaway political freight train. It's the U.S. Senate, which can slow down and often does slow down anything. There is no timetable for their consideration.
Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is Kate Apley, who is a reporter from Bloomberg News, who's here to discuss the big congressional battle over TikTok. Welcome to Headline DC, Kate. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with this. As they said in the CBS clip, the bill to ban TikTok passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. First of all, let me ask, is the opposition to TikTok largely a function of the fact that it is owned at some degree by a Chinese company? Or is it a concern about the impact that TikTok has on children? Or is it a mixture of both?
Well, there certainly is concern about just TikTok as an app and its effect on children and all that. But that's not what this bill that passed in the House last week would really deal with. It wouldn't make TikTok necessarily have to go away, but it would require that ByteDance, this Chinese parent company of TikTok, that it would have to divest of TikTok in order for the app to be usable in the United States. So, you know, people are saying, well, you'd have 6 months. The bill would set out 6 months before TikTok would have to be separated from ByteDance, its parent company. And, you know, we've heard sort of mixed thoughts, but that would be a very compressed time frame to, have the company become, independent or bought by someone else, and it's, basically no longer be owned by a Chinese parent company. So that's what this bill was about, not saying that TikTok couldn't operate in the United States, period, but saying that the app could not be available in 6 months if it had not, been separated or divested from ByteDance.
Okay. If the bill passes the Senate, we'll get to that in a minute, it is forced to sell. I understand one of the potential buyers is Donald Trump's former Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin.
Yeah, I saw that last week, too, that he's working on putting together a group of investors. I think a lot would have to happen, and it would have to happen quickly. But I did talk to some sources last week who think that maybe this bill doesn't pass, but even absent that there will be a mounting of pressure. It may take longer than 6 months or what have you, but that some people see it almost as an inevitability that TikTok may separate. Now that may not be a majority view, it may not, but there is that view. I talked to some sources who said that they could see that happening even without legislation, although it would be on a less compressed time schedule.
Now, if there is a sale of TikTok to Steven Mnuchin or anybody else, would there be any restrictions on content? I mean, some people are concerned about the use of this by kids and, violent, suggestive videos on the site. Would there be any restrictions on content if it's sold to an American?
Well, this particular bill doesn't really deal with TikTok content. There are other bills working their way through, particularly in the Senate, and also House members looking at legislation that would deal with social media and kids' online privacy. We've seen, some momentum behind some of that legislation. That would also, though, deal with Facebook and TikTok. So there are sort of different tracks going, or there's legislation on different tracks happening, some that deal with, kids' privacy, content at kids, as well as this. But what moved so quickly in the House last week dealt with the ownership of TikTok being a Chinese-based company.
Okay, one quick question. How do most national security experts feel about the connection between China and TikTok? Do they see it as a threat?
Well, I think even the people that I talked with on Capitol Hill, even, you know, there were, I think, about 50 Democrats that voted against this legislation last week, including many of the more progressive Democrats. And then, of course, there was a dozen or so, you know, Republicans and some of them conservatives that also voted against it. But in terms of talking to those folks who voted against this bill, they even said that they had concerns, that they acknowledged that there were problems. So I don't, you know, okay. I think it seems
gonna
like
it's pretty agreeable. I'm going to have to leave it at that, Kate, because we're coming up on a break for our radio listeners, but we will continue very soon with our viewers on Facebook and okay. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is Kate Ackley, who's a reporter for Bloomberg News. We just discussed the massive amounts of money that's being employed in the congressional battle of over TikTok. Now we are going to continue the discussion of money. I talk about the impact of money on campaign 2024. Now, Kate, it seems to me that we periodically, monthly and quarterly get these reports from federal congressional candidates and presidential candidates talking about how much money their campaigns are raising and spending, and also we get reports from some independent groups on how much money they're raising and spending, but we don't know. A lot of the money comes from dark money sources that we don't really know where it's coming from, or probably know where it's going. First of all, how much dark money is there in politics that voters can't trace the source?
Well, I think when we're talking about dark money, and it's, you know, depends on what you mean by dark money, but there are a number of super PACs and other kinds of outside groups. Now, super PACs themselves have to disclose their donors. But a lot of them have affiliated organizations that are usually 501c4s. And the donors to a 501c4 don't have to be disclosed in most situations. And so if a 501c4 then takes its money and puts it to the affiliated super PAC, then you don't really know where that money came from. So we can see a lot of these big money donors giving to some of the super PACs, but it's when they transfer money from affiliated organizations, then you can't see that. So you don't necessarily know who might those donors have been. You'll see a transfer from an affiliated group to the super PAC. Then another way is that those 501c4 organizations, while they're not super PACs or expressly political groups, they can run a lot of issue ads, and the issue ads sound a lot like political ads, frankly. You know, they're talking about either a really hot button issue, or they're telling you to call your member of Congress to do such and such, or to thank someone for voting a certain way or to vote a certain way. And so the donors to those types of groups are not disclosed, those C4s, which are oftentimes lobbying organizations, trade associations, and things like that. So there is a lot of money in the system that we don't see, but we do know what people spend advertising on. But I think TV ads, while still the bulk of political spending, you know, we're seeing more into the social media and other areas where maybe less money goes a little bit farther or is more targeted. So there's still a lot to sort of keep tabs on.
Okay. By the way, I want to remind our radio listeners, now that you're back, If you'd like to watch the show as well as listen to it, you can watch it live or the podcast afterwards on twitter.com/Brad Bannon or on facebook.com/DeadlineDC with Brad Bannon /videos. You know, Kate, I was reading an article. Tomorrow is U.S. Senate primary in Ohio. And in the article I was reading talked about all the independent ads that are being played, millions of dollars worth by various groups. One of the interesting aspects of that situation is that there is a Democratic bank spending money to promote one of the Republican U.S. Senate candidates, the one who's named Moreno, I guess, who was endorsed by Donald Trump. What's that all about?
You know, we've seen that in the past few cycles and probably before that, where you'll see a group that is on one side get involved in the primary of the other party because basically they figure somebody's a easier candidate to beat. You know, so if you're a Democrat, and you know, not all Democratic groups are going to do this, but if you're a Democratic group and you look at the field and you want to have some sort of, you know, sway over who comes out of that primary, some groups will do that and they will get involved. And one other thing I wanted to say about the dark money, another way, and it's maybe dark money is the right exact word, but there's a lot of money that comes into these groups right before a primary that's running ads right now that we won't know until after people have voted, until after the election is done. And so it's maybe temporarily dark money. You'll know at the end, after everybody's voted, now we know who put all that money in that super PAC to run ads or what have you. But it's, depending on when the disclosures are of the donors, you may not know until after the fact.
And this is all a product, am I right, of the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United?
That certainly paved the way for the increase in and independent expenditure groups. Yes, it opened the door for that.
Okay, and why is a Democratic group spending money to further the nomination of the Republican candidate in a race who is endorsed by Donald Trump?
I think it's because that Democratic group sees that candidate as a weaker candidate against against, in this case, Sherrod Brown. They see that as an easier to beat candidate. That would be why. I mean, I'm not saying in that specific example that is why, but that's generally why. They're trying to prop up who they believe would be a weaker candidate against their candidate in the general election.
Let me ask you one more question. We have about a minute left. What's happening in Colorado? We have Ken Buck, who is a Republican member of the House, who just announced his retirement almost immediately. And we also have Lauren Brobot, who is the denizen of progressive groups, running in a new district. What's going on there?
Right. Well, she's running for the seat that Buck has, but she's not running in the special election. So she's running to be there in the next Congress. So it's a little bit convoluted. I think the reports are that she viewed that as a safer seat, but didn't want to give up her current seat to run in the special election, because there is going to be a vacancy. As of Friday, Ken Buck will be gone. So, it makes it a little bit more of a convoluted situation where you have an opening, an empty seat for a period of time. There's going to be a special election later this spring in Colorado, but she's going to be on the ballot for the for 2020, for the fall of 2024.
Okay, Kate, thank you very much for joining us today. That's all the time we have. Our guest has been Kate Ackley, a reporter from Bloomberg Government, who was kind enough to talk about money in politics. We'll be right back. after these messages. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. In this half hour, we're going to discuss media coverage, mainstream media coverage of Donald Trump. Our guest to guide us through the discussion is Tim Carr, who is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Welcome to Deadline DC, Tim.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. First, before we get into the subject matter, tell us a little bit about Free Press.
Sure. Well, Free Press just celebrated our 20th anniversary. We've been around for 20 years. I've been with Free Press for the 19 of those years, but we're a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization that fights for a more just and democratic media system. And that involves, you know, looking at the way mainstream media is covering politics, something we're going to talk about today. But we also fight for universal access to open broadband networks. We're looking at the future of journalism and trying to find new ways to fund that. And we're involved in a whole range of projects related to a more democratic media.
Okay, we're going to play this clip now. Sunday, Donald Trump, last week, Donald Trump, who was clearly off the reservation these days. He seems to be getting nuttier and nuttier by the day. He talked about bloodletting again and said, anyway, let's just play the clip and you can react to it.
Donald Trump spoke at a rally in Ohio and we decided we have to start here.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars.
It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That will be the least of it. Now, the Trump team quickly said last night, nothing to see here. He was just talking about the auto industry. Consider the full context, everyone. Otherwise, it's irresponsible. Well, if they want us to consider the full context, let's do just that. Because the full context is that Trump kicked off the same exact rally by saluting the people who were convicted for the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, all to the tune of the national anthem sung by a choir of imprisoned insurrectionists. The full context is that some of the first words out of Trump's mouth last night, same rally, were thanking those rioters and calling them patriots. The full context is that he also said in this same rally, quote, if this election isn't won, I'm not sure that you'll ever have another election in this country. The full context is that he went on to say some undocumented immigrants are, quote, not people. And of course, the full context is that this is much bigger than one single speech. This embrace of political violence, this dehumanizing language, this is what Donald Trump has been preaching for years. In January, he warned that there will be, quote, bedlam in this country if his criminal prosecution derailed his campaign. Late last year, he echoed the dehumanizing language of Adolf Hitler, comparing his political opponents to vermin and saying immigrants are, quote, poisoning the blood of our country. Last month, he said there would be potential death and destruction if he was charged in the Manhattan criminal probe. And during his first term, he flat out refused to condemn the political violence at a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, saying there were very fine people on both sides. In 2020, he reportedly asked his defense secretary about shooting people who were protesting the death of George Floyd, saying, can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something. And of course, his very words inspired violence on January 6, 2021, when he told a crowd of his supporters to walk down to the Capitol and fight like hell because, quote, you'll never take back our country with weakness. Trust me, I could go on. And on and on. We all know by now that Trump's allusions to political violence are not merely rhetorical. His supporters take them literally. That's part of the big problem here. And he knows that too. So no, we did not miss the full context. This was not some meandering off-message comment. This is his message. As the Biden campaign put it, this is who Donald Trump is. A loser who gets beat by over 7 million votes and then instead of appealing to a wider mainstream audience, doubles down on his threats of political violence.
That was Jen Psaki from NSBC talking about Trump's latest outrage. Our guest in this half hour is Tim Carr. Again, he is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. First of all, you have, I read something you wrote, and you have serious problems with the way that mainstream media portrays Donald Trump. Could you talk about that, please, Tim?
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. You know, as former Representative Liz Cheney said, you know, America is sleepwalking into dictatorship. End quote. And if that's true, and I believe it is, given, you know, the list of statements that Trump has made, it is the American media that's providing us with the Ambien. That is to say that there are systemic problems in our commercial media system that have made it difficult for them to alert the general public to the threat that stands before them. There's a tendency to want to normalize the march of fascism, to tend to normalize political extremism or normalize calls to political violence, which are very much in evidence in that long list of quotes that were played at the top of the program.
Okay, well, let me ask you this question. If it was up to you, Ben Psaki, in a litany there of some of the most outrageous things Trump's said over the years, and those are just the highlights of the lowlights. How should the media deal with Donald Trump?
I think they need to recognize that this is not politics as usual. This is not political coverage as usual, which has a tendency to focus on this, on the horse race, on who's up, who's down, to treat any election as though it's a sporting event, right? To say who's ahead, who's behind, who's winning in this state, who's winning amongst these voters, instead of focusing on the stakes. What's at stake here? And every interview with Donald Trump or every news segment about Trump needs to be clear with their listeners that this is a person who incited political violence in an effort to overthrow a Democratic election in 2020. That is the news. And any news story on politics that doesn't report in that context is missing the main story here. And the problem is, again, it's not the usual suspects. Certainly, you know, if you think of a Trump-enabling media, the first outlets that come to mind would be like Fox News Channel, or other right-wing outlets, but it's actually mainstream media as well. I mean, you had a number of years ago, CBS then President Les Moonves, who said that while Donald Trump is not good for America, he's damn good for CBS. And then at the same time, CNN, Jeff Zucker, who was at CNN at the time, was giving 24/7 coverage to the Trump campaign. This was in 2016, while ignoring the other Republican candidates effectively because Trump was good for ratings. And this is the same Jeff Zucker who had previously been at NBC when he greenlit The Apprentice, which is a quote unquote reality television show that portrayed Donald Trump not as a failed businessman, but as an executive with impeccable credentials. And so the media created this person, and now they're enabling his rise to power. So again, it's not just the right-wing media, but it's the mainstream media. It's a commercial media that tends to put ratings above that canon of political coverage, which is that you comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. In this case, media is reluctant to go after powerful individuals like Donald Trump and ask those hard questions.
We just listened to that clip from MSNBC and Jen Psaki. She played the clip Trump saying there was going to be bloodshed and blood in the streets if he wasn't elected. Did she do it? Did she put that in context with her comments after the clip?
I think so. I mean, you know, Trump is very good at messaging, and he knows how to trigger his base, but always have a way out, right? So he can say, oh, I was just talking about the auto industry. This has nothing to do with inciting political violence, when in fact, a lot of his base gets the message. And the message is that should he lose in the upcoming election, 2024, there will be another potential coup attempt.
Jim, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we've got to take a very short break here. We'll be back with more of Tim Carr from Free Press after this very short break. Welcome back to Deadline. Steve, Brad Cannon. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, we have a little clip from you two there. Sunday, Bloody Sunday, which is very appropriate for coverage of Donald Trump. Our guest is Tim Carr, who is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Well, let me ask you this question, Tim. When I talk to my Democratic friends about coverage of President Biden, most of them get pretty exercised over any time that the media describes Joe Biden as old or befuddled. Is that comparable to what you know, Trump is running around talking about? I mean, is that coverage fair?
I think that you're comparing apples to pickaxes, right? Because on the one hand, sure, you have a president who's older than any former president, and you know, those raise legitimate concerns. But I certainly don't think that Joe Biden presents a fundamental threat to American democracy in the ways that Donald Trump does. So to treat both stories of that as having equal merit is problematic for sure.
Okay, let me give you another example which bothers me. Every night I watch you, I almost always watch one of the network news shows. The lead story on most days is about some bad storms sweeping the rain in Los Angeles, the fires in Texas. And I breathlessly await when they show these reports whether they make any reference to climate change. And occasionally they do, but not very often. Is that an example of what you're talking about?
I mean, I think it is. Certainly, there are commercial interests that would rather not that the news media not discuss climate change. So I think there are incentives. I mean, there used to be this idea, right, that there was this firewall that separated the marketing department from the news department within news outlets. And oftentimes that wall gets a little blurry, and there are significant, you know, financial interests in the energy sector who may may not like those connections, right? And so I think the problem is that you have to consider that when you have a hyper commercial media system and a hyper commercial news system, that those incentives are going to trump the obligation that journalists have to serve the public interest. And so that we need to rethink our approach to public interest media and what we need to do in order to ensure that we have one in the United States. And certainly there is a history of funding things like PBS and NPR, but that's based in a law that was passed in 1967. So here we are, you know, more than 50 years later, with a whole new news climate. In addition to the traditional outlets, we also have social media, which is very influential, right, in the ways that people that people think about politics and the way that that they learn about politics. So we need to do a wholesale reassessment of these issues and figure out a way to preserve public interest advocacy journalism at a time when thousands of journalists are being laid off. And we are indeed in a crisis moment, but it is not simply a problem of right-wing press or left-wing press. It's a systemic problem that really cuts to the root of journalism. And we need to kind of revisit ideas about what it is that journalism does within a democracy and make sure that we're passing policies and doing other things to support that over the long term.
Do you have an example of what you would like to see from another country in the way they cover politics?
Well, there are a lot of examples. The United Kingdom, for example, has a fee that people pay. Assumingly, it used to be a fee for their television that supported the BBC. Other countries have different models, but they do on a per capita basis. If you're looking at countries in Northern Europe and other parts of Asia, they do on a per capita basis fund public media at a much higher level. Now, there always have been concerns that you'll have then government influence, government telling what journalists what they should and shouldn't report on. But we in the United States and others have created these types of firewalls. That we've created a separate entity in the U.S. called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that is supposed to insulate against those types of influence. So it has been done. It is possible. There are also new ideas. I proposed a tax on social media companies like Facebook, like Google, tax on their advertising that would raise money for non-commercial media. That's something that a number of state houses here in the United States are taking a serious look at.
Okay. Is there anything, now PBS has a fine news show, the NewsHour. The networks are the CBS, NBC are confined pretty much to their half-hour news show. Is there anything that we can do to improve the coverage in the context of the 30-minute nightly network news, where they might have a package that runs that will show the Trump clip about bloodletting? And the anchor may frown or make a funny face when Trump says something ridiculous, which is often. Is there anything we can do to improve coverage in a 30-minute format, or is that just hopeless?
I think in many ways it is a dying model. Now those nightly news programs on the networks still command a fairly large audience, certainly larger audiences than watch MSNBC or CNN or Fox News Channel, via their cable subscriptions. But I think what we really need to look at is news consumption habits. We need to look at how different populations, different age groups, different ethnicities consume the news and figure out how you can give them access to reliable news and civic information that makes them, that encourages them to participate in democracy. And while that traditional news model may be dying off, there are a lot of online not-for-profit models that are doing interesting work in cities like Chicago and New York City and San Francisco and then across the country. And so we need to create systems where we can support that kind of local, independent, non-commercial journalism. A lot of states are looking at options. A lot of people in Congress in the United States are also looking at options. And I think they've come to accept that you really cannot have a healthy media system without a viable non-commercial alternative to commercial media.
Okay, well, you're right. I watch the nightly network news every night, but no one younger than me does. My kids certainly don't. you know, what is, can you give us an example of a way we could improve online coverage? Because that's how, you know, young people get their news these days, if they get any news at all.
I think you just have to support some of the new alternatives out there. You know, there are groups out there in New York City that there's an effort by foundations called Press Forward, which is planning to put $500 million, if not more, into the sector to create these sort of local news alternatives. They can be found through, if you search in your city, you can find new non-commercial options out there. I think, you know, we as news consumers have to do a little bit of our own legwork to figure out, based on where we live, where those options are. There are large parts of the country that don't have any news to speak of. They're called news deserts. They've been spreading since a lot of traditional newspapers have closed shop over the last 10 to 20 years. So there is a lot of work left to be done. But I think you're finding that there are more non-commercial, or you will find more non-commercial options out there that are doing a really good job of, like, you know, showing up at their at a local city hall meeting and asking questions or covering their state house so that we have that kind of local accountability journalism that is really serving the public interest.
Jim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Our guest in this half hour is Tim Carr, who is Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. I want to thank everybody who watched today. I want to thank our executive producer, Mark Rimaldi, who keeps this thing chugging along. We'll be back next week with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. So don't miss the show or you'll regret it.